Today's session is Hazardous Sites and Waste. And this is the fourth session in the summer school series. Our faculty today are Lewis Taylor, law firm of Venable in Baltimore, and Anna Cooperstein, law firm of Keller and Heckman here in D.C. And I'm going to introduce the panelists now. Lewis Taylor is an attorney in the Environmental Practice Group at the Venable Law Firm. His practice includes state and federal environmental regulatory compliance matters in criminal and civil environmental litigation. Mr. Taylor focuses particularly on issues arising under the Clean Water Act and CERCLA, but also has experience with the Clean Air Act, NEPA, and issues related to the energy industry. Anna Cooperstein is an attorney in the Environmental Practice Group at Keller and Heckman LLP. Ms. Cooperstein advises attorneys on compliance with federal, state, and foreign environmental regulations. Ms. Cooperstein specializes in regulation of pesticidal products under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, FIFRA. Her FIFRA practice includes assisting clients in obtaining federal and state registration for pesticides, labeling and advertising of pesticides, complying with the human subject research rule, and meeting specific reporting obligations. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's good to be here today, and thanks to everyone who's attending here in person and on the phone. In case you couldn't figure it out, my name's Lewis Taylor, and I'll be presenting the CERCLA portion of our program. Anna Cooperstein will be starting with an overview of RCRA, but first, we thought it would be helpful to get a sense of at least our live audience. Just by a show of hands, are there any college students here today? What about law students? Any attorneys? And are there anybody from private industry or other professionals? Okay. So it looks like we law students are dominating the group with a few other folks.
At what point these statutes get activated? So, you know, let's take a hypothetical company, a shoe manufacturer, we're going to call it Shebach, totally hypothetical, nothing to do with any real world company that may have a similar sounding name, Shebach. So let's say Shebach has this great idea for a new product. They're going to make shoes that are reflective on the surface. So the joggers, when they're running around at night, you know, usually put on some of those Velcro straps that have a reflective property. So if a car is coming towards you, they can sort of see you in the night. Shebach is going to do away with that. It's going to be a major revolution in the shoe industry. We're going to have reflective shoes. The problem is that in order to make their shoes reflective, they need some sort of special dye, special chemical, that they actually can't buy in the United States. So they have two options. They can either manufacture by using certain different chemicals and reacting them together in the United States, or they can import it from Japan. So that's where TSCA kicks in. It's the Toxic Substances Control Act. When you're going to manufacture a chemical substance or import a chemical substance, depending on what kind of chemical it is, you may have to notify EPA, you may have to conduct some testing. So that's really going to be their first step. All right, so let's say we've got that dye in the U.S., we imported it from Japan, complied with TSCA. Next, we need to mix it with some other chemicals in order to make this sort of like thin rubber layer that's going to go on top of the shoe that's going to have these reflective properties. And so we have this big manufacturing facility, it's a big plant, and, you know, something's got to power the plant. So we're probably going to have some boilers on site. So that probably means we're going to have some air emissions. That's where the Clean Air Act kicks in. Clean Air Act says, you know, you're probably going to have to get a permit for those air emissions, and the permit might implement some limits on the type of stuff that's going out into the air. So, for example, it might limit the sulfur dioxide content in your emissions. All right, so that's the Clean Air Act. Next, we're moving along, and we finally got the special reflective dye mixed into the rubber layer that's going to go on top of the shoe. And now we need to wash it down with some chemical, let's say cyanide. We're going to do a cyanide wash. You know, all that leftover water, where's that going to go? Are we just going to flush it down the toilet? Are we going to toss it out the window? Are we just going to dump it in the river? Well, no. For this, we look at the Clean Water Act, And the Clean Water Act, again, might impose some permitting requirements. It may impose some limits on the type of constituents that can be dumped into the waters of the United States. That's your Clean Water Act. All right, so now we've got our shoe. We're ready to ship. It's going to go out to the marketplace. But, you know, Schiebach discovers that throughout this whole process, this special reflective dye yielded some precipitates, and now we have some, like, gunk left over from this whole process. And the gunk is actually pretty toxic and dangerous. It's corrosive. It's ignitable. If you move it the wrong way, it might explode in your face. So we've got this gunk. What are we going to do with this gunk? Again, can we just bury it underground? Can we... Can I give it to Lewis and say, you take care of it, I don't want to deal with it? Well, no. So that's where we get into RCRA. RCRA is going to deal with this hazardous waste. We're going to talk later about what qualifies as hazardous waste. How do you know that you have hazardous waste on site, and what are you supposed to do with it? So just to go back to a little history for RCRA, you know, waste has been a problem from the dawn of time. You know, humans have always been producing waste. And in the last couple of centuries, more and more as we become active consumers, the more we consume, the more we throw out. You know, additionally, with the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, we started to produce waste in much greater quantities than individual per person. You know, I might have some egg cartons that I'm going to throw out, but Schiebach is going to have a ton of leftover waste from their manufacturing process. So the interest in managing waste really intensified in the 1800s and the 1900s. And, you know, just as an example of how the nature of our waste was changing, in the mid-1800s, New York could actually sell its street sweepings to buyers because it was mostly horse manure. So you could sell it and for use as a useful fertilizer. By the end of the 1800s, New York actually had to pay people to pick up its street sweeping. It was no longer really sort of useful material. It was just junk that nobody really wanted to take care of. And then, again, when we get to, you know, the post-World War II era, people are concerned about radioactive waste, nuclear waste, and a lot more industrial waste as more manufacturing facilities are popping up. And, you know, so industrial waste becomes a bigger problem, and also personal residential waste becomes a bigger problem. So just to give you an idea of magnitude of the problem we're talking about, in 1910, the average American person generated half a pound of municipal garbage per person per day. So every day I would generate half a pound of municipal garbage. By 1960, it was 2.7 pounds. And from there, it's only increased. So clearly there's a lot of reasons that people were concerned at the time. And, you know, Lewis is going to talk about this later, but there were also pollution incidents that got people really concerned, fatalities, miscarriages, diseases, cancer. So people were really worried about, you know, where is all this waste going? Where is the hazardous waste specifically going? Is it going to leak into our groundwater? Is it going to contaminate our food? So it became a serious, very, very serious issue. So just in terms of the legislative history of RCRA, which is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, the original law was actually the Solid Waste Disposal Act. It was amended by RCRA in 1976. The original Solid Waste Disposal Act really focused on generating research about waste and also providing some financial assistance to states in order for them to manage waste. So there wasn't really like a centralized regulatory framework. A very comprehensive system. Hazardous waste specifically. And some of the goals of RCRA are, you know, we want to sort of centralize the regulation of hazardous waste, but let states have a little bit of control of the non-hazardous municipal waste. We want to protect groundwater from contamination. We also want to reduce waste. It's not just about, you know, managing this all these tons of hazardous waste that are generated. We want to encourage people to really cut back and find a way, you know, can they use different manufacturing processes that reduce the waste that's outputted? Is there a way that they can recycle waste or reuse it once it's generated? So there are a couple different motivations here with RCRA. So today I'm going to talk about three major components of WordCrow. The big one is under Subtitle C, which manages hazardous waste. Subtitle C created a very restrictive cradle-to-grave tracking system for hazardous waste. Cradle-to-grave, this means from the time that hazardous waste is generated through its transportation to the time that it's eventually disposed or treated, we're going to have control over that entire life cycle of hazardous waste. We're going to track it from the very beginning to the very end. Subtitle D of WordCrow deals with non-hazardous waste. And this is really left up to the state. It's a permitting program for owners and operators of municipal landfills. And that's more for the kind of waste that you and I are generating as opposed to SHEBOC, which has all this like toxic hazardous stuff on site. And then Subtitle I deals with underground storage tanks, which is exactly what it sounds like. Tanks storing certain substances that are buried underground and may present a hazard to groundwater contamination. Okay, so I'm on slide 7, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Subtitle C, which deals with hazardous waste, because this is really the most of WordCrow. So, as I said before, our purpose with Subtitle C is to regulate hazardous waste from cradle to grave, the entire life cycle of hazardous waste, no matter where it comes from or where it goes. So, Subtitle C places certain responsibilities on three classes of facilities or people. People who generate hazardous waste, generators. People who transport hazardous waste, the transporters, people who are shipping hazardous waste. And finally, facilities that treat, store, and dispose of hazardous waste, sometimes called TSD facilities for short. Now, how do we accomplish this comprehensive tracking system? Well, we have a hazardous waste manifest system. And a manifest is it's going to be a piece of paper that functions really like a shadow for hazardous waste. Wherever hazardous waste goes, the manifest follows. And everybody that handles hazardous waste is going to have to sign off on that manifest so that at the end we know exactly where it's been, we know where it came from, where it went throughout the country, and where it ended up, and how much was transported, and what it is, really. So this is really done to ensure that we don't want to lose a giant tanker of hazardous waste along the way. And we don't want anybody who's not authorized to handle hazardous waste to be touching it because it's such dangerous material that Congress has decided, you know what, we really need special protections for this type of waste. So in terms of generators, a generator of hazardous waste has to obtain a government-issued ID. It also has to determine whether its waste are hazardous. So if you're a SHEBOC and you've got a bunch of gunk lying over there in the corner of your manufacturing facility, you have to understand whether it's hazardous or not. And later we're going to get to how do you make that determination. If the generator determines that they do have hazardous waste, they have to make sure that they store it properly and that they handle it properly. And there are specific regulations relating to the storage of hazardous waste depending on what type of waste you have. So if you're a SHEBOC and you want to get rid of your hazardous waste, you need to hire the right transporter, the right person to take your hazardous waste and ship it to a treatment facility. And you have to tell the transporter that your waste is hazardous. I can't just give it to Lewis and say, you know what, you're driving to the beach, could you take these couple of drums of stuff from me and just dump it in the ocean? No. You have to make sure that Lewis knows. So he's forewarned and he knows what he's dealing with. This is hazardous stuff, so now you know. And as we said before, the generator has to prepare a manifest about the hazardous waste, and it has to be sure that it can track the hazardous waste as it's moving along its life cycle. A generator also has to keep any records of test results that they do, any analysis that it performs on waste, and any other waste determination, so any information that it gathers. And it may also have some reporting obligations about the type of waste that's generated. who can be a generator? A variety of facilities and manufacturers can be generators. You know, even a small dry cleaner can be considered a generator. A car repair shop, a hospital, a photo processor, certainly large chemical manufacturers, and also petroleum refineries. So there's a lot of different classes of entities that can be considered generators of hazardous waste. There are also different classes of generators depending on how much hazardous waste you're generating. So if you're a large quantity generator, that means you're generating over 2,200 pounds per month. For a large quantity generator, you can store your hazardous waste on site for 90 days, and then you got to get it out there. You got to get it to a transporter and off to a treatment facility. For a small quantity generator, we're a little bit more generous in terms of the time frame because they only generate about 2,200 pounds per month. So between 200 and 2,200 pounds per month. Then we have the smallest class of generators, which are conditionally exempt small quantity generators. And these are generate, you know, less than 200 pounds of hazardous waste a month. So because they're not generating as much waste, we're going to exempt them from most of the requirements for generators. You know, they're still going to have to comply with the management standards, but it's not quite as rigorous as for the generators that are, you know, generating massive amounts of hazardous waste. And in slide 10, it's just a screenshot of what a manifest looks like. It's impossible to read, so don't try. But there's spaces to fill in information for, you know, the generator's name and location, the types of hazardous waste you're going to give to the transporter, how much, variety information. So this is the piece of paper that's going to follow hazardous waste wherever it goes. All right, so those are generators. So let's say Shebok knows it's got the hazardous waste, complied with RCRA, and is now ready to give it to a transporter. So now we're at the transporter level. The person or the entity that's going to ship the hazardous waste from the generator to the treatment facility. So like a generator, a transporter has to obtain a government ID, and they also have to label their shipments as hazardous waste. Again, they have to comply with regulations about handling the waste properly, and they have to make sure they transport the waste to a licensed treatment, storage, and disposal facility. You can't just, you know, have your hazardous waste on your tanker truck and then dump it into the ocean. You got to make sure that it gets to the facility that it's supposed to go to. And again, just like the generator, the transporter gets the manifest form, they're going to sign it, and they're going to pass it off when they actually deliver it to the treatment facility. And of course, for a transporter, there's additional liability because there can always be spills of hazardous waste along the way. We've all seen trucks turned over on the highway. So if that happens to be hazardous waste, the shipping company, the transporter, has to take immediate action protect human health and the environment. So that's another responsibility that is sort of placed on their shoulders. The last class of people that have a responsibility to RCRA are the treatment facilities, treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. Now they actually have to obtain a government-issued permit. So they need to provide a little bit more information than the transporters or the generators, which only need a government-issued ID. The treatment facility actually needs a permit to operate. So what do these facilities do? They store, treat, and dispose of waste, and they also have to make sure that the way in which they're dealing with the hazardous waste meets the regulations laid out by EPA. So, you know, they might be storing them in containers or containment buildings. They might be putting the hazardous waste or surface impoundments, or they might be putting them into tanks that are either sort of above ground or underground. And for all those types of containments of hazardous waste, there are special regulations about their design. Maybe they have to have a double wall. Maybe they have to have a special lining on a landfill to make sure the stuff doesn't leach into the groundwater. Of course, the treatment facility is going to get its manifest form. So so it has to sign the manifest and actually return it all the way back to generator. And that's how the generator gets confirmation that the hazardous waste actually arrived where it was supposed to go. A treatment facility also has to make sure that they have the financial resources to take corrective action if there's a spill or a leak. So in the same sense that a transporter is responsible for any hazardous waste releases that may happen while the hazardous waste is being shipped, the treatment facility has to prove that it will be able to pay for any the cleanup of any release that happens on its property. The treatment facility also has to make sure that it can clean up any prior contamination that occurred at the facility. So even if it happened before they got there, they're going to have to make sure and clean it up as well. And of course, one of our big concerns with RCRA is groundwater contamination. Got all this hazardous stuff, we're going to put it somewhere. A lot of times we put it out on the land, out in the open, we have to make sure that it doesn't contaminate the groundwater. So these treatment facilities, they have to do groundwater monitoring all the time to make sure that nothing is leaking into the groundwater and contaminating it. So on slide 13, these are just some pictures of, the first one is a picture of a secondary containment for tanks. So it's got this wall system, special tank around, and this is really to make sure that if the central containment system ruptures, that there's a wall on the outside to protect it from leaking out. And same sort of protections in the surface impoundment, which is the second picture at the bottom. There's a double liner, and you have, on the left, you have that groundwater monitoring system, which is what we talked about. You have to make sure you monitor the groundwater to make sure that none of the chemicals are leaching into the soil and water. And you also want to have some sort of dike on the outside so that if a spill occurs, it's not going to overflow into other areas. Okay, so now we have to really consider, what is a hazardous waste? When do you know that you're subject to all these many, many requirements if you have a hazardous waste on site? Well, first of all, hazardous waste has to be a solid waste. What is solid waste? Solid waste is defined as garbage, refuse, sludge, or other discarded material. So it's stuff that's not going to be used anymore. And there's still some back and forth about, you know, if I'm storing stuff on site that I intend to recycle, how long can I store it there before EPA says, you know what, you've been keeping this stuff here for 5 years, we're not going to buy that it's really discarded, recyclable material anymore. We're going to regulate that as discarded material. And the term solid waste is actually a little bit misleading because it can be a solid, it can be semi-solid or liquid, and it can also be a contained gas. Solid waste is just another one of those legal terms that really has a different meaning than what it sounds like. So you can have liquid, that's solid waste. Don't be fooled. Okay, so a hazardous waste has to be a solid waste. So now we have a solid waste. So how do we know that it makes that jump from just plain solid waste to hazardous waste? Well, there are some types of waste that EPA has said, you know what, we decided for a policy reason or for a science reason, this stuff, we're just going to say, if you have this kind of waste, it's hazardous waste. So oftentimes, waste that come from common manufacturing processes like wood preserving, that's going to be listed as a hazardous waste in the regulations. Then there are wastes that are called characteristic waste. So if you have a solid waste that's ignitable or corrosive, it's going to eat through normal steel drums, or reactive or toxic, it has some toxic properties, that's going to be hazardous as well. There are other types of hazardous waste. There's universal waste, used oil, and there are special provisions in the regulations for those types. So that's subtitle D with hazardous waste. Now we're moving on to that's subtitle C with hazardous waste. And now we're going to move on to subtitle D, which is non-hazardous solid waste. So this is more like the trash that you and I see every day, trash that you and I throw out. Any trash from residences, any non-recycled appliances, Or if you're a manufacturing facility, you could have non-hazardous waste. That also falls under subtitle B. Or even if, you know, Lilith or I are generating a little bit of hazardous waste, even though it may be technically qualified as hazardous waste, because it's coming from a residence, because it's coming from a household, you know, we're not going to have to prepare these manifests and get a transporter and go through the whole thing. That's considered, under the regulations, non-hazardous solid waste. And also, we talked earlier about generators, the very, very small generators, the conditionally exempt ones. Their hazardous wastes are also going to fall under subtitle D because it's such a small amount. So, as I said before, subtitle D for non-hazardous waste, we're really going to give a lot of power to the states. So we have a state-run permitting program for landfills to make sure that they meet regulations. Again, the design of the landfill, they have to do groundwater monitoring. They have to make sure that if there's some sort of leak or contamination, they have the money to pay for it. And if there is a leak, they have to take care of it. They also have to implement some public health and safety controls because, you know, you have these gigantic landfills with God knows what in it, which is not hazardous, but still, you know, it's a variety of different stuff. And they have to take special measures to make sure that it doesn't spread, that there's no sort of like methane gas explosion that happens because the waste is so concentrated. So, again, they have some responsibility. And on slide 18, this is just a picture of a solid waste landfill. And again, you see they have this thick liner on the bottom. They have a collection system for any stuff that's going to leak out of the landfill materials. As always, groundwater monitoring. Can't say it enough. RCRA is all about protecting groundwater. And also, as I said, we want to make sure that there's no explosive gases being generated. So we have a monitoring well for explosive gases as well. So what's the big deal between whether my waste is hazardous or not hazardous? Well, you know, as we discussed, if you have hazardous waste, there's a very strict regulatory system for managing it. From the people who generate the hazardous waste, the people who transport it, the people who eventually treat it, there's permits, there's IDs, there's reporting obligations. All this very strict regulatory scheme. For non-hazardous substances, it's much less burdensome. And right now, one of the current events issues is coal ash. Is coal ash hazardous waste or non-hazardous waste? Well, first of all, what is coal ash? So when you have power plants that are using coal, they're emitting fly ash, fly coal ash, into the air. And oftentimes, what we do is we mix that fly ash with water so that it's at least contained instead of flying all over everywhere. So then we have this appetizing slurry of water and coal ash. Well, about 2 years ago in Tennessee, there was a plant that was storing a slurry of ash and water in an 84-acre unlined pond above ground. And unfortunately, one of the containment walls of the pond ruptured in December of 2008, and 1.1 billion gallons of this coal slurry was released into the surrounding area. Just to give you an idea of the quantities we're talking about, over 1,500 Olympic-sized swimming pools of slurry. The volume was about 101 times larger than the XLVs. So we're talking about an incredible amount of coal ash slurry all over the place. Destroyed homes, destroyed power lines. It's still being cleaned up to this day. And EPA is estimating that it's going to cost about $1 billion to clean this mess up. And so now, really, we're asking, should it have been stored in a more protected fashion? Should we have thought about better how to contain it? Should we have lined the pond? And this is what's going on right now. And just for some visual images. This is an aerial shot of the ash slide, and the wall was right around here. I think you guys on the phone can't see me pointing my slide. So it spread all over its surrounding area. And again, this is what it looked like. You can see barely see the tops of the roofs of homes that were near the slurry slide. And it's still being cleaned up. It's a pretty sight. So this is why it's such a heated issue. An EPA proposed rule just last month, June 21st, really asking, you know, should we regulate coal ash as a hazardous waste or a non-hazardous waste? You know, as we talked about, there are a lot of differences between how you're going to be regulated and what is your responsibility if you're a hazardous versus non-hazardous waste. Well, in terms of enforcement, states and the feds, federal EPA can come after you if you're a hazardous waste. If you're non-hazardous, it's just going to be enforcement by the states or through citizen suits. So, for example, if Lewis here lives near a landfill and is harmed by it somehow, maybe it's released and it contaminates his property, he can't grow his tomatoes anymore, you know, he can sue. In terms of corrective action, if there's spill, again, if you're a hazardous waste, EPA and the feds are going to come in and make sure you do everything you need to do. But for non-hazardous waste, it's sort of self-implementing. We're going to trust you to do the best job you can. For hazardous waste, you need a permit. For non-hazardous, you don't. For hazardous waste, there are storage requirements, but not for non-hazardous. Both have liner requirements in terms of, you know, if there's a landfill or a surface impoundment, you have to make sure before you dump any waste in there, it's lined with a special material so we don't get groundwater contamination. And again, if you're going to be closing the site for a hazardous waste, it's going to be the feds that are going to step in. But for non-hazardous, we're going to sort of trust you to do it on your own a little bit more. Okay, in terms of other responsibilities under RCRA, of course you have to perform corrective action if there's any sort of spill or leak. So both for hazardous and non-hazardous, they have those responsibilities. And also, for many of these facilities, for the treatment, storage, and disposal facilities, we get to a point where, you know, somebody wants to close up shop or the facility has just sort of run its course. You can't just, you know, put the lock on the gate and skip town. You have to make sure that you take care of the waste that remains on site. So there's a term called clean closure. That's when a facility is able to remove all the waste that's on site and really clean it up. And then your responsibilities are sort of cut off at that point. But if you don't have clean closure, if it's impossible to remove the waste, or if you don't for whatever reason, even after you close the facility, you have to come back and do monitoring and make sure that the waste is still being contained in an appropriate manner. So what happens if you're not complying with RCRA? Well, there are civil penalties and there are criminal penalties as well, and they can be quite hefty. So if EPA determines that you're not complying with an aspect of RCRA, a treatment facility or a generator, they can be forced to pay a penalty of up to $37,500 per day of violation. And that adds up really, really quickly. EPA can also order you to do additional groundwater monitoring. EPA can order you to test your waste to determine the properties. And, of course, if there's any imminent threat to human health and the environment, EPA can also tell you, you know what, you got to take corrective action, you got to clean up, or you have to put in some sort of preventative measures. The criminal liabilities are always the most fun. You can be fined up to $50,000 a day, and you can get up to 5 years in prison for the following infractions. And this is where you really understand how important the manifest system is under Subtitle C for hazardous waste, that paperwork that has to follow the hazardous waste wherever it goes. So if I'm a transporter and I'm transporting hazardous waste without my manifest, or I'm giving it to Lewis here to dump in the ocean, he's not a permitted treatment facility, I can be fined up to $50,000 a day and spend up to 5 years in prison. The same with treatment facilities that don't have a permit, same criminal liabilities. And also for generators, you know, if Shebox doesn't file the right paperwork for their sludge on site, for their hazardous waste, similar criminal liabilities. All right, so now we're going to get away from the hazardous and non-hazardous waste discussion and talk about underground storage tanks. This is subtitle I of RCRA, and again, you see this emphasis on protecting groundwater. So oftentimes, you'll have tanks containing either petroleum or hazardous substances that are either buried underneath the ground or are above ground with underground piping. So if you have underground storage tanks, you have to comply with RCRA regulations. And you also, as in the other subtitles, you got to make sure that you have the money to pay for a cleanup if a release happens, if it breaks down over a number of years, if there's a spill. All right, so the type of tanks that are regulated under RCRA, subtitle I, so the tank has to be at least 10% underground. So traditionally, we think of an underground storage tank as, you know, we've got a tank that's all the way underground. But oftentimes, a tank can be above ground and have a lot of underground piping. So if its piping constitutes at least 10% of the whole system, then it's going to be regulated under subtitle I. The type of tanks that are not regulated under subtitle I are those that hold hazardous waste, because that gets us all the way back to our subtitle C, the primary one with all the manifests and all the paperwork. That's regulated there. And also small residential tanks. So if I have something in my backyard, that's not going to be regulated under RCRA. Okay. So for underground storage tanks, the owners and operators have to comply with EPA regulations on the design of those tanks. Again, there might be certain liner requirements to make sure that hazardous substances don't leak out of it. Whenever you're installing a new tank, you have to tell EPA. If you have old tanks that were on your site before, before RCRA was implemented, or before the regulations were implemented, then you have to upgrade them. And always, you have to prove that you're going to have the money to pay for a cleanup. Another issue that's coming up lately under RCRA is the international shipment of hazardous waste. And one of the reasons that this is a big issue right now is because of the concept of toxic colonialism. So, you know, the EPA, the U.S. has a lot of manufacturing facilities, very active in this country. And, you know, we can afford to take our hazardous waste and pay someone else in China or the Philippines to take it off our hands. Well, there's a little bit of a disparity there because we're just sort of shouldering off our responsibilities and using money to go ahead and not deal with that problem. So this is something that EPA has been addressing in the last couple of years, and EPA actually recently amended RCRA regulations to align with some decisions made by OECD, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. There are some provisions that relate to spent lead-acid batteries. So before I can ship it to China, I have to tell China that I have this hazardous waste, and I have to receive permission. Can't just do it sort of, you know, under the table, black market. There's an agreement there. It has to be formalized. And you have to make sure, you know, similar to the subtitle C requirements, that if I'm shipping my batteries overseas, I have to make sure that it goes somewhere that where they can deal with it. I can't just ship it off to some landfill that isn't lined, where people really aren't monitoring the groundwater to make sure there's contamination. I have to make sure that it's going to people who are qualified to take care of it. And just outside of the scope of RCRA, in terms of transboundary shipment of hazardous waste, international shipment of hazardous waste, there's an international treaty called the Basel Convention on the Control of Transboundary Movements of Hazardous Waste and Their Disposal, which is a mouthful. So it's the Basel Convention, and it's an international treaty that's designed to reduce movements of hazardous waste between different countries. And at this point, EPA is not a party, which means that they have to have a separate agreement in place for countries that are parties to the Basel Convention. So if I'm the U.S., and Lewis is
Paraguay.
Lewis is Paraguay. He's a party to the Basel Convention. And I want to give Lewis some hazardous waste as a birthday gift. We have to have a special agreement between the two of us to make sure that I can do that legally. And, you know, sort of at the end of the day, where are we left with RCRA? Has it been a success? You know, at the time that RCRA was enacted, the House committee wrote, you know, that RCRA eliminates the last remaining loophole in environmental law, that of unregulated land disposal of discarded material and hazardous waste, which is really like an adorably optimistic take on RCRA and about the state of environmental law in general. You know, I'm not sure that many people would agree that environmental law is done and done, pack it away, or...
Well, it's like the Clean Water Act that says all discharges to the nation's waters are going to cease by 1985.
Exactly. Very optimistic. You have to laud them for their optimism. But in terms of the numbers, it seems like RCRA has been at least a little bit of success. So, for example, in 1960, almost 94% of solid waste was just put into a landfill or disposed. In 2007, it's only 54% of solid waste that is disposed. And this really speaks to the preventative influence of RCRA. So we're trying to get people to reduce the type of waste that's generated. We're going to encourage people to recycle their waste or compost it or reuse it in some manner. And so in 2006, 32.5% of municipal solid waste generated in the U.S. was recycled. So almost a third, which is pretty impressive. In 2005, there were 15,000 large quantity generators. I don't know if that's something necessarily to brag about, but it is what it is. 18,000 transporters and 500 treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. So RCRA has certainly had an impact, and time will tell, especially with this coal ash regulation, where we go from here. And maybe at this point, the big battleground is, you know, we understand what the framework is for dealing with hazardous waste and non-hazardous waste. Maybe now the battleground is, you know, what's a hazardous waste? And maybe now we're going to see more and more efforts to make certain waste qualify as hazardous waste so that they're subject to this very restrictive regulatory system. And throughout this whole discussion, you know, we've been talking about how to prevent groundwater contamination, how to make sure that spills don't happen, how to make sure that we handle hazardous waste properly. And it's all about having a preventive effect. We want to prevent catastrophes from happening. That's RCRA. Now, CERCLA, which Lewis is actually going to talk about next, is all about, you know, what happens after the catastrophe. You know, that's the unfortunate part of the equation where something has already gone wrong, and now we got to figure out how to deal with it. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Lewis, opening his presentation.
So in many ways, RCRA, though it can be complicated, is relatively straightforward. CERCLA, not so much. My firm, by the way, is very concerned that you may forget the first letter of our name, so you'll be reminded of it throughout this presentation. I'm going to take Anna's Shebach example and present a couple hypotheticals for you all to think about as we go through this presentation, and I'm not nearly as organized as Anna is, so I'm going to ramble around a little bit more, so bear with me. But let's think about Shebach as a very responsible company who handled their hazardous waste according to federal law and beyond at the time. They did everything they possibly could. They sought the best disposal facilities. They only sent their waste to disposal facilities that were state-of-the-art, federally licensed. Even after RCRA in 76, they fully comply with RCRA. But come to find out, 15 years, 20 years later, the landfills that they used were leaching into the groundwater. Should they be responsible for cleaning up those landfills to the tune of millions of dollars when they complied with the law? Not only that, but should they be jointly and severally liable, which means that even though there may have been 100 parties that sent waste to that landfill, they're the only one that's still around, that's still in business. Everybody else is bankrupt and gone, so they get to pay for the whole kit and caboodle, everything. Is that fair? Is that constitutional? Is it a violation of due process? These are some of the questions that have kept CERCLA in a state of constant evolution throughout its history. You know, and to flip that example a little bit, let's say that Shevok was run by a bunch of jerks, and they basically just packed everything up in cardboard boxes and threw it out in the woods behind the factory and went out of business and are no longer around. Well, who gets to pay for that? The taxpayers or somebody that maybe contributed to that dump in the woods other than Shevok? So the principle behind CERCLA when Congress enacted it in 1980 was that, you know, the polluter should pay. And even though it's not necessarily the most equitable thing, it's better that someone who generated profits or was in the business of creating the pollution to pay than it is for the innocent taxpayers. So I'm going to begin with kind of a real rough, quick overview, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about the liability provisions, which are still, as I mentioned, in a state of flux. As Anna mentioned, Congress thought in 76 they'd pass endangered species, clean water, clean air. They thought, we got it done, we're just going to handle these hazardous wastes and everything will be good. Well, come to find out, for reasons we'll talk about in a little minute, that it wasn't all good. And they had to enact CERCLA, which empowers the federal government, gives it specific authorities to address the cleanup of sites that are contaminated with hazardous substances. It specifically allocates liability to certain parties, and it authorizes certain causes of action for various parties to seek reimbursement when they clean up sites. So Love Canal, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more, kind of hit the front pages in about 78, and Congress enacted CERCLA pretty hastily, which is one of the reasons why we're still figuring out the liability provisions today. It primarily addresses the cleanup of hazardous waste sites, but it also contains some spill reporting provisions, and more recently amendments have included brownfields, redevelopment rules, and funding mechanisms. Superfund, which is often what you'll hear CERCLA referred to, is the trust fund that was established by the Act and funded by taxes on petroleum and chemical producers, which expired, but the taxes expired, I believe, in 95, and the fund still had money in it up to about 2003. It no longer does, so when there's a site that is eligible for Superfund funding, Congress will make specific appropriations, and so annually Congress makes a specific appropriation for CERCLA monies to clean up various sites. We're going to talk a little bit more about Superfund later. So as I kind of referenced at the beginning, CERCLA imposes this very unusual form of severe joint and several liability. It's strict liability, meaning you don't have to have any negligence. And it's joint and several, meaning you're on the hook for the whole thing, even though there might have been other parties that they can't get. And it's retroactive, which of course raises, you know, concerns about ex post facto laws. authorizes EPA to compel PRPs, potentially responsible parties, to perform cleanups and reimburse the government. And it provides those private parties, not only PRPs, but other innocent landowners or other people that states that clean up properties to recover monies they've spent. And as I've said, we're still in a state of flux with the Supreme Court case coming out in 2009 that has kind of re-highlighted the ability to apportion costs and not be bound by joint and several liability. CERCLA was modeled on common law theories of liability. And so the restatement of torts, I think it's section 433A, talks about joint and several liability. And if there's a way to apportion harm, in other words, Anna and I are driving down the road and she hits you and you break your arm and everyone sees, oh, he's broken his arm, and then I drive over you and break your leg, and we can clearly distinguish that she broke your arm and I broke your leg, well, you can apportion. But if we hit you at the same time, each of us is going to be on the hook for the total damage because you won't be able to apportion it. The ability to apportion has been in the law from the beginning because of the common law basis, but it kind of got lost, and Burlington Northern, which we'll talk about later, has re-energized it. So I'm on slide 4, which is a big landfill, which is the most common Superfund site. 1 in 4 Americans live within 3 miles of one of these, especially if you live on one of the coasts or you live in a manufacturing state like Michigan or Ohio. You're going to live near a Superfund site. As Anna alluded to, you know, in the late 1800s and throughout the 20th century, industry kind of chugged along, progress moved along, but progress in waste management didn't move along as well. You can see in that bottom right-hand picture, there's rail lines that are going through there. Rail lines tend to be places of contamination because they would go out to various steel mills or mining centers, two very common places for CERCLA contamination. This picture is actually from an area in Australia. I'm sorry that the projector is kind of making our pictures look a little funky, but I put this in here because I want a lot of, besides rail lines, a lot of industrial centers are located along rivers, and so rivers can become contaminated too. Right now, the Hudson River, 200 miles of the Hudson River, is a Superfund site. They're dredging for PCBs even as we speak. GE is one of the responsible parties there. They have very recently kind of lost the last leg of their constitutional challenges to CERCLA. So even now, 30 years after the passage of the Act, people are still challenging the constitutional basis for CERCLA. So Love Canal, I just want to talk about it a little bit because it's such an amazing story. There's a canal. Some guy built a canal about in the 1800s that didn't work out. The local municipality began to use it as a landfill, basically. This chemical company, Hooker Chemical Company, was looking for a place to dump their waste and got permission to use this canal and ended up later buying it. And then there was this population boom in the area after World War II, so in the 50s. And the school board was desperate for land, so they came to Hooker and they said, listen, we want to buy this land. And Hooker said, you can't. It's totally contaminated. Forget about it. And the school board kept after them. So they sold them the land eventually for $1 with detailed indemnification, you know, limitations of liability. The site's contaminated. You shouldn't be using it. You know, we have no responsibility. Well, they've built schools. They've built residential developments over the years. You know, 55-gallon drums of waste started bubbling up to the surface. There's one residence where a pool literally popped out of the ground and was floating on a sea of goo. There were birth defects, miscarriages, and some local journalists in the community basically brought this issue to national attention and was a primary motivator for the passage of CERCLA. So here's some basic CERCLA provisions, and those are little section symbols. I don't know what my system's doing here, but those little circles with lines in them are actually section symbols. This is pretty self-explanatory. Definitions, the reporting requirements, which I'll cover a little bit, the authority of EPA to order information and cleanup of sites, the liability, the 107 was the initial primary liability provision. 113 came later and is a contribution provision, Superfunds in 111, and there's some cleanup standards in 121. So here's the whole list of CERCLA's amendments. Which, as I said, was passed very quickly, so they kept going back. 1986, well, let's skip to the next slide. So they passed CERCLA, and this woman, Rita Lavelle, gets appointed to the Office of Solid Waste and is just basically dragging her. She was formerly a public relations executive with some companies, aerospace companies. She really wasn't doing her job, and there were also some irregularities with where funding was going, particularly related to one site. So she was subsequently convicted of lying to Congress and served prison time. In 2005, she got in trouble with the feds again and went back to jail. Ann Gorsuch was the EPA administrator at the time. Congress was trying to do oversight of EPA regarding funding, and she refused to provide certain documents. The White House was claiming executive privilege. The White House dropped its claim. They ended up giving the documents to Congress, and she ended up resigning. So kind of on the tail of that, Congress was a little ticked off that its, you know, fix for all these hazardous waste sites wasn't working very well. So they went back and passed SARA, which, as legend goes, a congressional staffer named after his girlfriend, by figuring out what the acronym should be. And it made some considerable changes to the act, increasing state involvement, putting in more standards about how exactly you had to clean up sites, increasing the fund of Superfund, the amount of Superfund. In 1986, the Asset Conservation Act was passed, which did several things, but most importantly as regards CERCLA, it codified the EPA's lender liability rule, which I'm going to talk about because as a practicing attorney, this is an issue that comes up a lot. You may not ever work on an actual Superfund site, but there's lots of issues related to whether a merger acquisition or a property acquisition is going to create risk for a client of yours, whether you're an attorney or an environmental consultant. And so I'm going to talk about a couple of those things, one of which is the lender liability rule, which courts had kind of developed on their own. And EPA made into a rule, but then the courts struck it down, and so Congress codified it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And then in 2002, Congress amended CERCLA again, put in a municipal solid waste exemption, which is similar to the exemption that Anna was talking about regarding RCRA, where it didn't make, you know, the folks sitting in this room that put cans of paint in the trash a liable party under CERCLA. And there's also a de micromis exception under the Act. It's pretty small. If you're an industry, you're not going to probably qualify. And it created this robust brownfields program. It created rules for acquiring properties that are contaminated. You know they're contaminated. You can work with EPA or sometimes states to acquire these properties and not expose yourself to liability as an owner of the property. So this is just how EPA organizes itself regarding CERCLA management. At the bottom, you see OECA, which is the Office of Enforcement, Compliance, and Assurance, and DOJ, Energy and Natural Resources, Environmental Enforcement Section. They're the folks that, if you're a liable party and you're not paying for cleanup, the DOJ is going to come have a word with you. So, to go down in a level of detail, CERCLA governs the cleanup of hazardous substances, which is not necessarily hazardous waste, although it's inclusive of that. It's not exclusively that. It's broadly defined in the federal regs, but it also references RCRA, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, TSCA, it does not, and this is an important thing to understand about CERCLA, it does not include petroleum products. So if there's a gas station that's been contaminated by gasoline or oil, that site may not be a CERCLA site. There are some technical issues regarding whether you've added something to the petroleum. So for example, if you've added MTBE, which is a component they add to gasoline to make it burn better, MTBE contamination may be a CERCLA issue, but the petroleum contamination isn't. There are other statutes regulating petroleum cleanup, but CERCLA has a petroleum exclusion. A release or threatened release. So you don't necessarily have to have the 55-gallon drums leaking all over the place. If they've been abandoned and they're sitting at this abandoned property, which is surprisingly common, this old factory in the South, someone went out of business years ago and no one's paying any attention to it. 20 years later, someone comes along and there's 155-gallon drums of who knows what. If there's a threatened release, they can take action. And you see this very, this, you know, kind of long-winded definition. It's really the release or threatened release of a disposal of the hazardous substance. There's no minimum quantity threshold. There's this de micromis exception. But what that means is if you were a company that operated back in the 60s and you're now owned by a successor company and you put 1% of the waste into this landfill and these three other companies put in the other 99%, you're still on the hook, as I said, joint and severally liable. Facility, it's a threatened release from a facility. Facility basically means anywhere anything's been disposed of. All of these issues have been litigated and are the subject of extensive literature, and I invite you to check them out if you're interested. So, potentially responsible parties. Owners and operators. That includes current owners, past owners, and it includes past owners who own the site at the time of the disposal, but it also can include intervening owners who didn't have anything to do with the disposal, but maybe learned about it and didn't disclose it when they sold the property. The operator is a definition is another term that's been heavily litigated because obviously multiple parties can be considered operators of a site. Basically, it's a participated in management kind of decision. There's a lot of case law, Best Foods, big Supreme Court case on the issue regarding whether a corporate parent can be liable as an owner of its subsidiary's actions if it's involved in day-to-day management, and I'll talk a little bit more about participation in management in a minute. You can pierce the corporate veil and get that corporate parent. I'm not going to really go into that, but owners and operators is very broad. The whole statute, anytime you read a CERCLA case, begins with CERCLA to be broadly construed as a remedial statute. So all of these definitions are broadly construed by the courts. Generators and arrangers. Generators are the obvious. You know, I'm a company. I call this trucking company to come pick up my waste and take it to the landfill. I'm a generator. Arrangers is another term that is hard to define but can include people that are not necessarily generators but are arranging for the disposal of waste. So I can't really go into that in too much detail, but there's plenty out there if you want to learn more. And then transporters, which is just the same as RCRA. If you're transporting, if you are a transporter of hazardous wastes or hazardous substances, you can be on the hook. So waste management, other big sanitation companies, you know, the guys that go around on the trucks and pick up your trash, these guys have legions of attorneys that work on CERCLA nonstop. The statute says any person can be liable. It includes corporations and government entities, including federal and state government entities. Exempted parties. So what do you do if you bought a piece of property and you didn't know, but you find out a couple years later there's 55-gallon drums buried, you know, on the back 40? If you conduct due diligence on the property and there's no evidence that that property is contaminated, then you can possibly escape liability. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. This is one of the areas where attorneys spend a lot of time. I read a lot of environmental site assessment reports to determine whether someone's leasing the property, because there's issues when you come onto a property. Maybe you don't own it, but you come onto it, it's contaminated, and you need to dig a trench to put in your utility lines. Well, when you dig the trench, if that soil is contaminated, it doesn't have to be in 55-gallon drums. You now become an operator because you've taken a hazardous substance and you've moved it around. So you really want to be aware of what you're getting into when you acquire property. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. Contiguous property owners. So you're adjacent. You live adjacent to a property and stuff's migrated onto your property. This stuff gets in the soil and in the groundwater and it can move. Certain things like dry cleaning solvents are like race cars underground. It's really strange. But you're exempt if you're a continuous property owner and you didn't do anything again to exacerbate the problem. Secured creditors, I'm going to talk about lender liability exemption. If you're only owning the property because of a security interest, you've given a loan to someone and they've gone out and buy the property and they've gone bankrupt and you're foreclosing. Well, now you're the owner of the property. So are you liable? We'll talk about that. Bona fide prospective purchasers, these are people that buy a property knowing it's contaminated, working with the feds or the state in the voluntary cleanup program. And then there's certain exceptions for government entities that acquire, if they acquire the property because of a bankruptcy or something, they're not liable. And if they acquire property by eminent domain, they're not liable. But again, they can become liable pretty quickly depending on what they're doing on the property. So all appropriate inquiry. After CERCLA was enacted, it had a chilling effect on lenders. People did not want to lend money to people that were going to be buying property in our cities that might be contaminated. And literally credit kind of dried up, kind of like it has now. So the courts kind of developed a judicial rule saying, well, if they're just holding the security interest because they're giving out a loan, they're not really, they really shouldn't be liable. And so EPA said, that makes sense. So we're going to codify that rule. They did a formal rulemaking. They made the rule. And then a court, Kelly, I had it on an earlier slide, said, EPA, you can't do that. The statute says if you're an owner, you're liable. These people are owners. They're liable. So Congress came in and amended the act to codify this lender liability rule, which I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, and I guess I told you I wasn't organized. My slides are maybe a little bit out of order here, but bear with me. So the rule, there's specific rules about what you kind of have to do. You do a regulatory review. You look around at adjacent properties. You look and see what the history of the property is. They go back and they look at topographic maps from the late 1800s and city directories and anything you can do within reason to determine what may have been going on this property 50, 100 years ago. There's a standard. ASTM is a nonprofit standards writing organization. They have a standard that's not necessarily the legal standard. I mean, it's generally accepted, but it's not, the standard's not codified, in other words. So there are codified guidelines, but most folks go by the standard. So, lender liability rule. If you're performing certain activities, like you're going to lend money and you want to conduct an environmental audit to see if there's stuff going on at the site, or you say to the person you're lending money to, you need to comply, or this contract says you're going to comply with all environmental regulations, does that make you an operator at the site? Because you're controlling what's going on. You're telling them you've got to comply with environmental laws. Well, the statute says no, that you can conduct that kind of general contractual obligations to comply with the law without incurring operator liability. Similarly, if you have a right under the contract to enter into the property and take control, that doesn't make you an owner either unless you exercise it. So the critical issue is participation and management, because what happens is many lenders are not necessarily banks lending to a separate entity that's going and buying the property. There may be corporate relationships. There may be other relationships. It may not be a bank doing the lending. It may be somebody who's not getting paid by a company, so they get a mortgage on the property. So it can get rather technical. These contracts have various different terms about what the mortgagor can do or can't do. So the rule is whether you're actually participating in the management of the facility, and many of the cases say day-to-day management. As I said before, it doesn't include the capacity to control. You have to actually exercise that. If you make decisions about environmental compliance, if you exercise overall management control, or if you exercise overall management control except your contract says we exercise control over everything except environmental compliance, that there's a specific provision that says you can't do that. Once a lender forecloses on a property, they have a certain amount of time, which is completely undefined, there's not a lot of case law on this, to act to divest themselves of the property as is commercially reasonable under the circumstances. And that will vary depending on whether it's a big property that's going to take you a while, you know, to sell, or it's not. It's, you know, it's just a strip mall somewhere in a hot market. So if you take actions to list the property, you can, you know, protect yourself for a while. If you hang on to the property, basically if you hang on to the property to derive investment income from the property and not just to preserve your security interest, you can become liable. There's other questions about what you do once you foreclose on the property and you're on the property. Should you be taking actions if you know there's stuff there to, you know, protect the environment from some hazardous substances? These questions are somewhat ill-defined. You can act, obviously, to prevent that without incurring operator liability, but you better be careful, and it's best if that's the situation, that you begin a dialogue with state or federal authorities. Cover yourself. Major defenses. Basically, there are no defenses under CERCLA. These are, you know, what they have, an act of God. So, you know, the lightning strikes a tank and it blows up and puts hazardous substances on your property. You're still probably going to be liable, unless you can demonstrate that you did everything possible to prevent lightning from striking your tank. An act of war. Or a third party. This is a little bit different. If someone comes onto your property and you've taken precautions to prevent it and dumps hazardous waste on your property, you won't be liable. But it's your burden to prove that it was a third party and not your activity. And the other thing is you can always contest the elements of whether it's a hazardous substance, whether there's been a release, whether it's a facility. So I'm going to briefly, even though I've been talking about it throughout, cover liability, and then we're going to go on to a couple other things, and I'll get in a little bit more to what liability actually means. So liability occurs if there's a release or threatened release of a hazardous substance from a facility, and you can be liable for costs by the state or the feds or an Indian tribe or any other person. We're going to discuss this because it's not as plain as it seems. You're liable for these costs if they're consistent with the National Contingency Plan, which are the regs about how you clean up a site. I'll talk about that in a minute. The government's presumed to act in accordance with the National Contingency Plan. A private party isn't. So if someone's coming after you because you both dumped at this landfill, they have to have incurred costs cleaning up the site. They can't just, and that those costs have to be incurred consistent with, have to be necessary costs consistent with the National Contingency Plan. So as you can see, in 2009, EPA got commitments, which is not money in the bank, for $2.4 million. This is a big business. DOJ spends a lot of time collecting CERCLA money, in part because the Superfund is empty. So here's the National Contingency Plan. You're welcome to go check out the CFR. It's riveting stuff, I can tell you. It was originally kind of enacted under the Clean Water Act to deal with oil spills and other releases of hazardous substances to the water. And then CERCLA kind of rejiggered it in 1980, and the Oil Pollution Control Law in 1994 added some more provisions. It, like many of environmental laws, was put in place after this Torrey Canyon tanker sank off the coast of England, releasing hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil. The National Priorities List is kind of a confusing thing, to me anyway. There are many CERCLA sites. EPA has identified like 50,000 sites that might be potentially actionable under CERCLA, one way or the other. But because there's so many sites, they created a national priorities list, and there is a process of ranking to get on this list, but many sites aren't on it. The distinctions are that it affects certain kinds of funding, and for example, we're going to talk about the two different types of removal actions in a minute. One of them, the longer term big cleanup of a site, you can't get funding from the Superfund for a site unless it's listed on the NPL. But if you're an attorney for a client and there's a question about whether it should be on the NPL or not, you don't want it on the NPL because it cuts off a lot of avenues of potential funding. State voluntary cleanup programs, brownfield stuff, you can't get some of that if it's on the NPL. The NPL is much higher profile. It has serious effects on property values. You can search on the EPA website, by the way, if you go and just put in NPL and find out the closest NPL site to you. And there's,
so you can visit?
There's plenty of room. New Jersey leads the pack. Anybody here from New Jersey? This one. So you know all about CERCLA, right? Well, you will by the end of the day. So here's a list, and you can see the Northeast Corridor is slightly contaminated. As I mentioned, there's two. I hope I'm not talking too fast. It's just kind of my nature. Removal actions are emergency actions. You know, there's 55-gallon drums of cyanides sitting next to that school. We've got to go out there and clean it up right now. That's a removal action. Typically, there's going to be limited to about a year, although, as with many things under federal law, that can be. There's some wiggle room. Non-NPL listed sites can be funded. There's a $2 million limit. Remediation sites are much more complex, involve study, the development of a remediation plan, can take years and years and years, usually do. And as I said, only NPL sites can be funded from the Superfund. And they're very expensive. So the remediation process, this is just a very brief outline of how things work. You know, a site will be discovered, and there'll be an investigation. The EPA will issue 104E letters to everybody and their brother saying, we think you sent waste to this landfill. Please search your records and give us everything you have. And you better comply under penalty of federal law. So that process takes a while. Everyone starts looking what they have. They start trying to figure out if they can allocate, well, we only sent this, or we only sent trash. Trash is a technical word for, you know, paper and cardboard and not hazardous chemicals. Then there'll be a remedial investigation and a feasibility study that's going to involve public participation. It'll begin with the scoping process of what do we got here, what are the bases that we need to cover. Then they'll begin to characterize the site. Environmental engineers will go out there and take soil samples and do groundwater monitoring. They'll begin to consider alternatives. You know, what are we going to? There's various things about what you can do. For example, if groundwater is contaminated, what do you do? It's, you know, down in the ground and it's hard to fix. So there are different ways of doing that. I'm not an engineer, but it's expensive, and there's lots of arguments about which is the best process. The record of decision is a formal document about, okay, this is what we're going to do, this is what, how we're going to clean up this site, and then that's implemented. And litigation doesn't come after this. It's been going on in all likelihood for a while now. It depends because certain causes of action don't accrue until monies have been spent, but money will have been spent on a lot of this. What many folks do if there's a landfill, excuse me, not an industrial site, but a landfill, you'll have steering committees or allocation committees where all the big guys in the room get together, you know, the local energy, often the city government, the hospitals, whatever heavy manufacturing was there. They form a committee and they all pony up a couple hundred grand and they try and work together to allocate responsibility because litigation is so expensive these days, especially in the era of electronic discovery. So just to digress a little bit from our liability conversation, CERCLA does have reporting requirements with criminal provisions. Any person in charge of a facility, which often can just be a supervisor, it doesn't have to be the manager, when a hazardous substance is released, other than a federally permitted release, i.e. you have a Clean Water Act permit or a clean air permit that you didn't violate, or a RCRA permit. Well, RCRA doesn't permit releases, but of a certain quantity, so you have a release of a certain quantity, and there's reportable quantities listed in the CFR, depending on what the hazardous substance is. Often it's about like 100 pounds, depends on what it is. Who fails to immediately notify the appropriate agency as soon as he or she has knowledge or submits false information can be imprisoned for up to 3 years and subject to fine. So you see this little picture up in the corner of our slide, and we're on slide 26 for those of you following along on the phone. That's a meth lab. There's been a couple of cases recently where they're bringing CERCLA criminal actions against people operating meth labs for failure to report releases of hazardous substances. And you
can't believe you didn't report yourself in your meth lab.
Well, thanks, Anna. Now I have. So there's a case down there if you want to go take a look at that. That case was actually remanded for sentencing issues, but I couldn't find the other case I wanted to put up. So just to go back a little bit, one of the hot issues right now is Superfund and whether the tax is coming back. Because it's been such a big problem, because there's dozens of attorneys over at DOJ spending their time filing subpoenas, trying to get people who are filing bankruptcy, which is a whole other issue we're not going to go into, whether CERCLA of damages can be discharged in bankruptcy. There have been, over the years, efforts to revitalize the Superfund tax. There's a considerable groundswell right now, particularly what's going on in the Gulf, to refund the fund. So you can read through these bullet points. EPA is pushing this. Frank Lautenberg, who is from New Jersey, has been a senator for many years. He's kind of took a term off, and then someone died or became governor, and he came back. He has spent a lot of time working on hazardous waste issues. He's from New Jersey. And the tax basically would be what it was in 1980, and you can see it here. Petroleum and chemical companies, you know, for very legitimate reasons, are not interested in getting taxed to pay for cleanups that they're not necessarily responsible for. So it's going to be interesting to see, along with the coal ash issue, you know, where the wind is blowing on these things. All right, CERCLA liability. It's retroactive, meaning it goes back. I'm working on a big project where the landfill closed before the 60s ended. And there have been spent a couple of years now trying to figure out, doing the RIFs, the remedial investigation feasibility study, trying to figure out, you know, how they're going to clean it up. And all of these companies, you know, did what they were supposed to do. Now, of course, what they were supposed to do back in the 60s wasn't much. And I can tell you, it's kind of scary reading about these guys at this landfill driving bulldozers over drums that explode and people catch fire and all kinds of fun stuff. But strict liability, as I mentioned. There's no negligence, no illegal activity required. Joint and several. And no causation. So you don't, let's say you contributed a non-de minimis quantity of hazardous substance X to a site. But the reason the site's contaminated is because all this other stuff that the steel mill or this whoever put there, your stuff's not really causing a problem. Doesn't matter. You don't need to have any causation, which is a traditional tort issue for you lawsuits out there. It's CERCLA is really kind of bizarre in this regard. There's no causation required. They can clean up the site. If your site, if your substance was hazardous, it doesn't matter if they're cleaning it up because of you or not. You're on the hook. You can't contract away. You can enter into indemnity agreements when you purchase property that the seller is going to indemnify you for any environmental issues, cleanups or whatever, and you can go after that guy if he's still solvent, if he's got the money to pay you, if he's not in Rio having a good laugh over his mojito at your expense. The government doesn't care. The government is going to come after you regardless of what your indemnification agreement says. So the way a, you know, liability begins, the site begins to get investigated, EPA begins to order a remedial action, investigation. They may enter into a settlement with some PRPs. Everyone's watching to see what the other PRPs are going to do because there are certain provisions of CERCLA that protect you if you enter into settlement with the government, although those are a little bit confused because of recent case law. So there's this constant strategizing about you know, how you're going to handle, when you're going to sue the other PRPs that maybe didn't join your little allocation committee. You're kind of waiting, you know, if you didn't join the committee, you're just waiting for the hammer to drop. There's a citizen supervision that I'm not going to talk about, but basically any regulation or standard in CERCLA, someone can, a citizen suit can sue. It's going to be more for reporting releases and stuff, because the citizen's not going to be able to recoup cleanup costs unless they've gone out and cleaned the site for some reason. Yeah. Let me wrap this up real quick.
Well, actually, we don't have any questions from the callers.
Okay.
So we may not have any questions.
I'm going to fly through this, and we'll end with at least, we should end with about 10 minutes for questions, I promise. There's two, because this is, there's this, we could spend a whole day on this. 107 was the initial liability provision. It's a cost recovery action. If you incurred costs cleaning up a site, you can go get those costs back from someone else. 13 came later. It's a contribution action. You had to pay money out to clean up a site, and you want another party to contribute. These are tort concepts, which I'll flesh out a little bit. A plaintiff, particularly under 107, has to have incurred costs. So Keytronic is a Supreme Court case from 94 that talks about the fact that 107 doesn't actually have a liability provision. It's, what it says is that a party, an owner, operator, generator, is liable for, it says it's liable to the U.S. for cleanup costs, and it says it's liable for the costs incurred by any other party. It doesn't say it's liable to the other party, it says it's liable for those costs. So it's kind of a little ambiguous. Courts began to interpret it as having an implied right of action, that you could go, obviously it means you go get those monies. Congress liked that, and so they put in this 113 that kind of codified that you could do that. Well, when that happened, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm sorry, I'm going to fly through this, but if you look at the cases, you'll have a fun time trying to figure it all out. But 107 is the statute that identifies responsible parties. It states what I just said. Volunteers, right now, it's pretty clear they can sue. So if you're an innocent landowner, you didn't know it was contaminated, and you start cleaning it up, you can go after people under 107 to recover the costs that you spent, if they're consistent with the National Contingency Plan, from PRPs. There's a longer statute of limitations under 107, depending. It varies depending on when actions began. Contribution actions are qualified. You can bring them when you've resolved your liability to the U.S. or if you're in a civil action. You've gotten a judgment against you that says you've got to pay this money. You can go get contribution from other PRPs. Under 113 on these contribution actions, the courts will perform something of an equitable analysis. They use these Gore factors, which are named after Al Gore, who introduced them to amend CERCLA. They didn't go in the statute, but they're used by the courts, and which is why I say here causation can be considered in the allocation. So what was happening was that after 113 got passed, the courts changed their mind. They said, well, you can't, PRPs can't sue under 107, only volunteers can. So they let PRPs sue under 113, even though it said you have to be in a civil action or resolve your liability. Even though PRPs didn't do that, the courts let them do it anyway. Supreme Court said, you guys can't do that. It expressly did not answer the question whether PRP could go back and get cost recovery under 107. In this case in particular, the plaintiff brought a 107 and a 113 action. The court said you can't bring a 107 action, only 113. So they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they said you can't bring a 113. You got to go back and get a 107. This is CERCLA. PRPs and volunteers are not amused because now there's this question. Can they get anything back? If PRPs can't bring an action under 107, and they can't do it under 113 unless they've resolved their liability or are involved in a civil action, if you're a potentially responsible party and you clean up a site, can you get your money back? Well, under Atlantic Research, the court said 113 and 107 aren't distinct. They're overlapping. They didn't really explain it, and there's been a lot of court wrangling about, litigation wrangling about, what qualifies as what. And I could talk about this all day, but we're going to run out of time. There's questions about, what a volunteer is. If you enter into a settlement agreement with EPA that says, this settlement agreement, you're going to pay all this money to clean up the site, this resolves your liability to the U.S., but you haven't paid it yet, have you resolved your liability to the U.S.? Well, it depends what court you're in. So y'all can look at these slides. I'll briefly mention Burlington Northern, which I talked about at the beginning. There's a useful products defense under CERCLA. If I'm a company and I sell you a product because you're using it in your manufacturing process and you end up burying it in the back 40, I'm not liable. Now, useful products cover a wide range of things. Sometimes I'll use an acid bath, and when I'm finished with it, I'm going to sell it to you because you've got something you can do with it, even though I'm done with it. Is that a waste product? Is it a useful product? Burlington Northern involved Shell, which sent chemicals to this rail yard facility where they leaked. Shell knew they leaked. The argument by the government was they knew this leak was going to happen, therefore they were disposing of it. The court said you have to have intent. You have to have intent to dispose of the material in order to have ranger liability. The district court in this case performed its own allocation analysis. There were various sections of this property. Some stuff didn't go to part of the property. The court, sua sponte, did its allocation determination. It was not briefed, which is bizarre. Okay, the Supreme Court said, it was overturned by the Ninth Circuit. The Supreme Court said, this makes sense. The judge explained it. This is a reasonable basis for dividing up contributions. So there was like, ding dong, the witch is dead. Now we can allocate responsibility. We only put 10% of that stuff there, so we're only responsible for 10% of the cost of cleaning up that site. Well, hold your horses. John Gruden, who's at ENRD, DOJ, has an excellent speech on this that came out. If you search Google, you can find it. He's like, this, allocation was there before. This is not the, death knell of joint and several. And he's basically right, but it's going to be interesting to see. I can guarantee you that the reasonable basis the district court used in Burlington Northern is not going to hold up in other cases. You're going to need a lot of technical information, you know, in order to allocate, or some kind of unusual circumstances where it's very clear that, but this is what everyone's trying to figure out right now, how to, you know, do that. Managing circle liability, as I kind of talked about before, know what you're getting into, do a risk assessment. Environmental assurance has come back after having gone away because of the, you know, lender liability and other provisions that have been put in place. And as I said, you can get an indemnification agreement, but oftentimes those don't work because the party goes insolvent. So here's some rah-rahs on how well CERCLA works, and some sites that have, you know, turned a gold calcification plant into a playground, and this other site into a McDonald's, which is much better land use.
It's a playground.
Yeah, playground. The top site is, there's tons and tons of guidance about all of the issues I discussed today and other issues on EPA's website. You'll see stuff like interim guidance from 1985. Well, guess what? It's not interim. It is interim, but it's actually the guidance that you're supposed to be using today because they never really did anything with it. Aliaba's got some good materials. I'm sorry. I don't know why that happened. ELI. Also, GAO and... CRS, if anybody's interning on the Hill, Congressional Research Service, there's documents online that you can get, Government Accountability Office. They have excellent reports on these issues. So I guess that I'll stop there and see if there's any questions. Oh, I'm sorry. U.S. Annotated Code, U.S. Code Annotated, which most libraries where you're working will have the U.S. Code Annotated, I hope. It's not just the statute. At the end of the statute, it has references to cases. It has references to secondary sources. I use it all the time if you're looking at a particular issue. It's very handy. So that leaves us 2 minutes for questions. Yes.
Since the Superfund ran out in 2003 and DOJ's been bringing more suits to recover money, have they gone after only the site, the people responsible for the NPL sites, or have they gone after kind of everybody?
No, all sites.
Okay.
All sites. Yeah. Many, many, many sites. A site has to be a pretty big deal to get on the NPL, and most sites aren't. But they're suing. And most times, the EPA will issue an order to clean up a site or to begin a remediation study, and people comply because big, major American Fortune 500 companies are involved here, and they have already budgeted for it. You know, it's become pretty clear that they're going to have to spend money, and so they don't litigate it. They will. GE has been in this ongoing battle. Lawrence Tribe, who's a constitutional scholar at Harvard, I think, has written a lot of treatises on constitutional law, is one of their attorneys. And I can't imagine what they spend, and they lost. So that's a long answer to your question.
My name's Antonio Castro. I don't think the microphone's on, but I'm sure you can hear me.
It's recording.
Oh, it's recording. Okay. My question is for Anna. You mentioned that certain chemicals or materials require testing under TSCA if they're imported or manufactured. What is the trigger for that testing? What requires testing and what doesn't?
Under TSCA, there is a chemical substances inventory, which I believe in the 1970s, what EPA did was it took a survey of the existing chemicals and went ahead and grandfathered them and put them onto this list. And if you're manufacturing and importing a chemical on that list, then you can import or manufacture at will. You don't have to do any sort of report. There's no reporting obligations. However, if you're manufacturing or importing a new chemical substance that's not on the list, you have to notify EPA, and EPA has a window of time during which they can come back and sort of impose some more requirements. Under other sections of TSCA, EPA can also require testing of certain substances. Under Section 6, they can ban substances or require some sort of labeling or restrict the uses. Say, you know, you can only really use this substance in this one particular manner. Any other use, you're going to have to come to us first to get approval.
Well, I'm glad to see everyone's still awake. So thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.